This is a Crowd podcast.
The Milky Way is a big galaxy, and it's full of stars. There's a trillion stars, and there's also several billion solar masses of gas.
This is Dr. Tony Stark.
And the stars form out of the gas, and then the stars, when they get old, they blow off gas, and that gas winds up circulating around the galaxy for a while, and then winds up back in stars again.
He was Rodney Mark's supervisor, and he's explaining exactly what Rodney was researching at the South Pole in the year 2000. Galaxies, and how stars came to be.
All of this astronomy at the South Pole is undergoing and is part of a golden age of observational cosmology, where we have learned in amazing detail how the early universe started and how it developed. A lot of that is the result of these preliminary experiments which Rodney helped contribute to.
At the height of Rodney's data collection, in the middle of the Antarctic winter, he suddenly fell ill when walking back to the base from the remote observatory where he worked. Over the next 36 hours, his condition worsened. In this episode, we're going to reconstruct the final week of Rodney's life. There's a difficulty when telling these kinds of historic stories. Some people may have forgotten or misremembered some moment or detail. After all, this took place 24 years ago. In piecing together the lead-up to Rodney's death, we're relying on written testimonies and first-hand accounts from those who were there. These memories can be fallible, but taken together, these sources give us a good indication of what Rodney's last days and then his final hours may have looked like. This is the secret history of Antarctica. It's a few days before Rodney falls ill, the 5th of May 2000, a Friday.
The 5th of May was Cinco de Mayo, you know, the Mexican Independence Day, and there was a party that day.
This is Gene, the astrophysicist who you heard in the last episode. He'd met Rodney back in Australia when they were both doing their PhDs, and he's one of that year's winter overs, spending the winter on the ice.
Because of the isolation and stuff, all the little sort of ceremonies and things that mark time, I guess, down there are always celebrated as much as possible, right? So an excuse to have a party is normally a reason to let your hair down a bit and have fun.
There's a photo of Rodney from that night. The band he's in with his girlfriend Sonia is playing a gig. Rodney's hair is long, with a pink dye tinge, just visible beneath the sombrero on his head. He's got a pink and white shirt on, and the flash of the camera is reflecting off the silver rings on his fingers. He's holding a white electric guitar and singing into the mic.
He could play drums, he could play guitar, he could probably sing. I don't remember if he sang or not. I think he probably did. He was one of the main members of the band. Most people would have had a really good time. People would have been drinking or whatever, as you want to do at a party.
Rodney is a vibrant figure in this crowd, a regular at the bar and a heavy smoker. He's a dab hand at poker and could drink his friends under the table.
I guess he could sort of maybe what you call, you know, bridge the gap a little bit. He was equally comfortable talking science with a scientist as he was just shooting the breeze with someone else, like if they were a carpenter or a power plant mechanic or the chef or whoever. So, you know, always seemed to be pretty happy.
What did people drink down there?
Well, I mean, the mostly commercially provided beer, spirits, wine. At the time, the thing that you could do, the list went around in the summer and you got asked, how much alcohol do you think you would like to have over the winter and what do you want? So you could put down, I'm going to drink a case of beer a week. I'm going to be here for 30 weeks. So I want 30 cases of beer, and that would go on the list.
Rodney has a reputation as a binge drinker. but friends say he drank partly to mask the symptoms of his Tourette's. Alcohol use is rife in Antarctica, and it's something we'll come back to. The celebration ends, and everyone heads back to their dorms. The weekend passes, and then it's Monday again. Back out to Maipo for Rodney, the remote observatory where he's conducting his experiments.
He was an excellent fellow. I mean, he did a first-rate thesis.
You heard Tony Stark at the beginning of this episode. He's in charge of Rodney's research and is in constant contact with him the week he falls ill.
The amazing thing about Rodney, right, is that he'd come to astronomy after apparently being something of a rock star in Sydney in the 80s, and then he very successfully switched over to the beginnings of an astronomical career and did a fine job at it.
They'd got to know each other back in America.
My one long day with Rodney was that he wanted very much to go swimming in the Atlantic. He had never seen the Atlantic before. And one day, toward the end of the summer, he asked me to take him to a beach. And he and I had a day going off to the beaches of southern New Hampshire and having a swim and lunch and then driving back. So he got to immerse himself in the Atlantic.
Must have been cold.
Yes, it's pretty cold. It's the Gulf of Maine, and it's good for the whales, good for the lobster, good for shrimp, but cold if you really want to swim.
But nothing like the South Pole.
Oh, well, yes. South Pole is really, really cold. I mean, when the first time you go down, you step out of the airplane, and the thought was, I never imagined that it could be as cold as this, because it's, even in the summer, it's colder than the coldest walk-in freezer that you've ever experienced.
Rodney's speciality at the South Pole is using radio waves to map the skies. This is a complex form of astronomy that yields highly accurate results, which he then sends back to Tony in Boston.
I was playing the role at that time of the single point of contact. One thing we had done for our particular project was, in order to avoid confusion and in order to give the winter overs a clear set of instructions as to what to do, we followed the protocol that was developed in the military of a single point in contact. In other words, other people could send messages to Rodney and other people could talk to him, but the direction of his work only came from one person, and that was me at the time.
One day, Rodney's outside driving the snowmobile when he starts having difficulty breathing. His girlfriend Sonia takes him to the doctor, who would later say shortness of breath is a common complaint at the South Pole because of the high altitudes. So the doctor isn't particularly worried. He does, however, notice two needle marks in Rodney's right arm. He'd first seen them right at the start of the season, and Rodney had admitted to taking heroin at a party in Christchurch before arriving in Antarctica. It seems like a one-off, but the doctor decides to keep a close eye on him. After taking on some oxygen, Rodney feels better, and he goes back to work.
It was going great. All of the instruments were working, the telescope was working, and Rodney was doing a first-rate job having everything ready for the Sirius data collection for the winter.
So you had no indications whatsoever in the lead-up to his death that things weren't just okay, 100%.
Well, the week before, he got sick and he felt really bad, which was kind of surprising because, you know, once the base closes toward the third week in February, after the base closes, nobody gets sick anymore, right? Because nobody's bringing in new viruses. And so the 50 people who are there are all healthy. They've all gotten over all of their colds and everything, and nobody gets sick anymore. But Rodney, toward the beginning of May, got sick. And I told him to see the doctor and, you know, stay in bed, that everything was really ready to go. And so he could just, you know, leave the experiment for however long it took him to recover. And, you know, once he felt better, we'd get back to work.
I'm very interested in that. So by the time somebody had been down there that long, they've acclimatized. And like you said, it would be highly unusual for anybody to fall ill.
Yes. So it was a bit mysterious. And, you know, I figured the doctor would handle it, right? I mean, that was not my responsibility. I could just tell him to go see the doctor.
How were you communicating with him at this stage?
Well, back then it was almost entirely email because the communications were, you know, rather sketchy. Depending on the satellites, there might be an 8-hour period out of 24 where there would be no communications whatsoever. But, you know, with everything going well, it was just an email exchange or several email exchanges a day.
And so we come to the early hours of Friday, the 12th of May. Rodney, who'd gone to bed early the night before, has barely slept. He keeps waking, he's restless, and he's vomiting blood. By 5:30 a.m. on the morning of the 12th, he gets out of bed for good. Sonia rings the station doctor, who tells them to come to the clinic, a small building known as Biomed. The doctor, Robert Thompson, takes some blood, and that's when he notices those two needle marks again in Rodney's right arm. These next words are read by an actor, taken straight from Dr. Thompson's statement to police.
I made the comment to the patient that the vein appeared to be well used. We made eye contact, and I had the intuitive feeling he understood the implications of my statement.
In years to come, these needle marks will be of interest to the police. But for now, the doctor leaves it at that. He orders Rodney to cut back on the drink, and he gives him something for stomach ulcers before sending him back to his room. But at 1 p.m, Rodney returns to Biomed. Dr. Thompson later says he appeared nervous, anxious, scared and upset. And this time, he's wearing sunglasses, which is very odd. It's the middle of winter. The sun won't rise for another 4 months. Dr. Thompson thinks Rodney's suffering from alcohol withdrawal, but the intensity of his symptoms is worrying. Rodney is getting more and more agitated. At one point, he breaks down and starts crying. "I just want to know what's wrong with me," he says. Here's the doctor.
At this point, I would like to have run some blood chemistries on him, at least some electrolyte, ammonia, and liver function tests, but our Ectochem machine was not functional.
What the doctors just said about the machine will be crucial. More on that later. With his blood machine down, the doctor gives Rodney something for anxiety and puts him on oxygen, which helps. Rodney starts to perk up, so much so that the doctor leaves him with Sonia, who hasn't left Rodney's side, to grab a bite to eat. When he comes back, about 20 minutes later, Rodney's smiling. "That drug helped," he says. "I want some more of that." The doctor prescribes Valium and discharges him. Here are the doctor's words about what happened next.
His third and final visit that same day was at 15:35 hours, almost 2 hours since leaving Biomed. His SO was at his side as always.
SO means significant other. That's Sonia.
For the first time ever, he complained of pain all over. He was hyperventilating. He was starting to become uncooperative, and his agitation was getting worse.
The doctor's now baffled. By 4:30, almost 12 hours since Rodney first came to the clinic, the situation has gone from serious to critical. "He was getting disoriented," says Sonia. "It was like he couldn't move at a slow speed. The doctor feels he's losing control of Rodney physically because he's so agitated, so gives him an antipsychotic to calm him down. This seemed to help."
He asked if he could lie down in a regular bed. So he walked unassisted to the back of Biomed, where we have two hospital beds, and laid down. He started moaning with each breath. 10 minutes later, he became unresponsive.
Sonia is still by Rodney's side. "I thought he was getting better," she later tells the police. "His pupils were huge. They got smaller. He squeezed my hand. He tried to sit up. He then quit breathing, and we tried CPR.
There was some conversations, a little bit more of a, hey, rumor mill, hey, did you hear Rodney was not feeling well? He's in medical.
We met Dave in the last episode. He's one of the carpenters helping build the new research station.
But it happens, and no one thought anything serious of it. A bunch of us were in the cafeteria, and all of a sudden the fire alarm got pulled. So the entire station, the alarm was going off, which was not used in that setting only for fires, but it was in an emergency. And the doctor came over the loudspeaker and said that he needed the medical team, the trauma team, to report the medical immediately that this is an emergency.
Alone on the ice, with only a doctor and his friends for help, Rodney's running out of options. But why can't he be rescued? Because when things go wrong on this vast, isolated continent, you are trapped, especially in the middle of winter. Even if a plane manages to navigate the dangerously high winds and complete darkness, the temperatures are so low, the aircraft's engine could freeze up. On those rare instances where there is a rescue, it requires extraordinary heroism.
I had a very, very traumatic experience which shaped my life, actually, and almost died as a result of it as well.
This is John Dudney, who we met in the last episode. These days, John is an historian and author. His recent book, Footsteps in the Snow, covers his very long career in Antarctica. He loves the place, and he can't stay away.
That's true. It gets under your skin, and you can't get it out. And, you know, it's as fresh today as it was the first time I went.
John has a story that shows the extreme limits this wild continent can push you to, the complete isolation in times of crisis, and the near impossibility of rescues. When he was just 23, John, a talented scientist, was put in charge of a research station on the Antarctic Peninsula, the youngest base commander the British had ever had. He had 12 members of staff. Incredibly, he was also their doctor and their dentist, without any training.
For a variety of reasons, there was no doctor on the station, and there was no means of reaching the station. And I had, in the middle of the winter, a member of the base who went down with acute ulcerative colitis.
This is a kind of bowel disease, which, if untreated, can be life-threatening.
So we had to nurse him by radio. I had to learn how to nurse him. I mean, at one point, early on in the crisis, which started just before midwinter, I was basically having to think, well, what am I going to do with the corpse? Because the guy was dying, and we didn't have any of the drugs to treat him. We had a 24-hour nursing regime. We were having to describe the contents of his bedpan in minute detail every day to a doctor on another station. It was a very, very difficult time.
The man's condition is critical. They decide to fly him to a different station on the peninsula, closer to the coast. From there, he can be picked up by ship and taken north to Argentina and to a hospital. They set off along the small, icy runway, John in the back with the sick man and an Argentine doctor. The plane's engine is straining in the cold, but they lift off, headed for open sea. Very quickly, things go wrong. It's foggy and so cold that the aeroplane's engine and wings literally freeze. By the time they're airborne, they're not actually flying properly. The pilot's stuck. If he tries to turn the plane around, he probably won't make it back safely to land. But if he goes on, they're headed straight for the open water and a sea temperature of -2.
So the pilot's trying to turn back. They'd swung in an arc back towards where they thought they could get on the ground, but out of the mist loomed an iceberg. Luckily, this iceberg had a dip through the middle of it, and they managed to get the plane into the dip. And one wing scraped across the iceberg, and so as we came over the other side of the iceberg, we weren't a flying machine anymore. I was being thrown around in the back of the aeroplane because I had no harness or anything. And the door burst open next to me, and I looked out and I saw what I thought was an iceberg. So the next thing I know, I was standing on this iceberg looking back at the plane. I don't know how I managed to get out of the aeroplane so quickly, but I did, and realised that actually we were on a small island, and the plane was slowly settling in what's known as the tide crack, the space between the land ice and the sea ice, which opens and closes as the tide goes up and down. And then we were able to get the guy out of the aeroplane, get him in a sleeping bag on shore, by which time my boots were freezing up, so I had to take him out of his sleeping bag, take his boots off, put him back in again, steal his boots so I wouldn't get frozen feet. And then it was quite close to the base, so within a few hours the base members were there to help us.
And you all got through okay?
And we all walked away from it without any injury at all, and that's largely because the aeroplane didn't catch fire, it didn't explode. But it was a pretty sorry mess. It wasn't an aeroplane that was ever going to fly again. I was put in danger on several occasions. I mean, the Antarctic is a dangerous place, and so you have got to manage the risks. The real issue, I think, is not the environment, but it's being in an isolated location and unable to get away. You've got to have a very particular mindset that can deal with that, that can deal with interacting with people who you wouldn't necessarily choose as your friends, to form effective teams to deal with life in the Antarctic. You know, that's the most important thing, actually, is that the team works well as a single team and doesn't break up into factions.
Miraculously, the sick man survived the plane crash and made it to the new base. He had to wait another few months before the ship arrived to take him north to Argentina. But in the end, despite the heroic efforts made by John and his colleagues, the man's illness had spread. He died not long after. And so we return to Rodney, fighting for his life, with a rescue attempt out of the question. Dr. Robert Thompson is the only doctor on base, responsible for the medical care of all 50 station staff. He'd arrived at the South Pole just before Rodney, in October 1999. Only 6 months into the job, he's got a major medical emergency, and he's completely alone. He has no nurses to help him, no formal medical assistance of any kind.
You were isolated. You could not get out for the winter, and it would have been harder to get out of the South Pole than it would have been to get from the space station for medical care.
This is Dr. Ron Szymanski. He was the doctor at the South Pole the year after Rodney died, and like Dr. Thompson, lived and worked in Biomed, the clinic.
Had my bed, had my office. They had a very small lab, and we had our instruments in there.
Now, speaking of instruments, one thing that features in the Rodney case was this particular blood machine. Could you tell me what this machine does, how it helps, and whether you ever used it?
It is called an ectocam. And it does a variety of blood tests, basic blood tests, nothing fancy. It was really the only instrument we had for any determinations at the South Pole.
So in a real emergency, of all the things in your lab, this was the main tool, or indeed perhaps the only tool for a diagnosis, yes?
Yes, we could do a blood determination as far as how much hemoglobin the patient had, and did have a microscope that we could look at blood smears if we needed to, but that was about it.
We heard about this ectocam machine earlier. The doctor wanted to use it to run crucial blood tests on Rodney, which could have helped him make a diagnosis. But it's not working. Its battery is dead, meaning the machine loses its calibration every time it turns off. It would take 9 hours to recalibrate. Time the doctor simply doesn't have. The station manager has been trying to ring colleagues back in the US to see if they can help. But that doesn't work either. The base's only link to the outside world is an internet connection and a satellite phone, and both are currently down. The South Pole doesn't get a signal for much of each day. Back then, satellite communications weren't the thing of wonder that they are today. Dr. Szymanski says this isolation was the single biggest challenge a South Pole doctor faced back then.
When I went down there in 2000, you're pretty much on your own. There really was no organized medical backup. You were expected to just depend on what contacts you had before you went down there. Call your friends back in the States and ask them questions if you had problems. I found that to be very unsatisfactory because the doctors that you would be calling would have no idea what you were dealing with.
It's 6 p.m. on Friday, May 12th, 30 hours into Rodney's ordeal. The station's fire alarm has just been pulled, alerting the west of base to the emergency. Dave the carpenter is part of the trauma team. This is a group of volunteers whose real jobs are anything from scientist to plumber. They'd received basic training in emergency response. Dave is in the cafeteria when the alarm goes off. Dr. Thompson's voice comes over the speaker. He needs the trauma team to come to Biomed immediately.
So myself and a few other people that were part of that team immediately went to medical, and at that point, Rodney had already gone into cardiac arrest, I believe it was, and he was starting to do CPR on him and basically try to revive him. Sonia was in there, and there was a few others that came in with me, and it was just kind of chaos because he didn't know what to do. The doctor had no idea where to start, because it just went from him not feeling that well to all of a sudden his heart stopped.
Rodney had slipped into a coma. They start CPR and give him drugs by IV, trying to restart his heart. Dr. Thompson is giving directions.
He was trying to get some people to help with this and that, and then it was anyone else, just go, get out of here. So I backed out, as well as a couple other folks. We just got out of there, went back to the cafeteria, and sat around and just stared at each other for probably the next 30 minutes, trying to figure out what was going on.
There were just a few people left in the room, including Sonia, Rodney's good friend Darren, and the doctor. For 50 minutes, they battle to save his life. They rotate as they tire.
And then we got word not that long after that Rodney had passed.
It's 6:40 p.m. Rodney is declared dead. He's just 32 years old. Darren Schneider is one of Rodney's closest friends on base. They'd bonded over being the only two Australians there. Darren later writes on his blog, "We did everything we could, but Rodney did not come back. He had friends around him at the end. We have no idea what happened." It will be 6 months before winter ends. 6 months before a plane can fly out to retrieve the body. 6 months before they can start to find out what killed Rodney. An investigation that will reveal a shocking cause of death. Next time on The Secret History of Antarctica.
An Australian national dying on a United States base in a place which doesn't actually have full governance. Who takes responsibility? Who cares what happens? I don't know.
Before we even left there, we knew that the New Zealand police were going to have an interest in it.
The Secret History of Antarctica is a Crowd Network original. It's presented by me, Stephen Davis, and produced by Anna Stauffenberg. Mixing and sound design is by Rory Alskuri. The music we use is from our partners, BMG Production Music. Thanks to Luis Rodriguez at Sonic Space Lab Music for studio recording, and to Derek Shetterly for his readings. To binge the whole series ad-free, and for exclusive bonus episodes, subscribe to the Crowd Stories channel on the Apple Podcasts app. You can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music. If you haven't already, listen to the first two Secret History series. The Secret History of Flight 149 is the tale behind how a passenger plane got caught in a war zone, leaving hundreds of people at the mercy of Saddam Hussein. Hear from the human shields who were held hostage in Kuwait, and from those who've spent years searching for the truth. Series 2, The Secret History of the Estonia, is my investigation into what really happened when a passenger ferry sank in the Baltic Sea, killing 852 people. A story of secrets, smugglers, and spies that leads back to the Cold War. Find both of those series on the same feed. Thanks for listening.
Crowd Network, a place where you belong.